Blog Talk Radio.
For the radio voice of Eastern Airlines to bring you more Eastern talk, news, and history of the greatest airline to fly the skies, Eastern Airlines. Thanks for tuning in to this 307th live radio broadcast. We're broadcasting from many areas around the country. My name is Chuck Albright, and along with our other host and guests, we hope you will share in the conversation tonight, which, by the way, is an open mic Monday. This means you're welcome to bring any topic to the kitchen table, as Nee likes to refer to our show. As a reminder about how to sign into the show and call in, if you have comments, you want to join in with the host, we all need you to come by. Go to www.ealradioshow.com and look for the radio icon on the home page. Check the arrow in the circle at 7 p.m. and you can listen on your computer. Or you can also tune in by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. This site is the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio. Now here's an easier way. Just call 213-816-1611 and at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You can listen right in on your phone. You can also join in the conversation by just saying hi. Since you're already on your phone, we want to hear from you. Now let's get this episode in the air and see what we have for this trip. Now, let's get flight 307 into the air.
Flight attendants, prepare for departure, please. Captain, we have completed the cabin departure announcements, and we're secure for departure.
Dorothy, thank you. And Don, will you let Los Angeles Tower know that we're ready for takeoff, please?
Sure, Captain. LA Tower, Eastern 307 Heavy, is now ready for takeoff.
Roger, Eastern 307 Heavy. Hey, you guys, you're in a new plane today, aren't you? Haven't seen that one before. When did you bring that one on board?
Yeah, you're right. It's a new Boeing 747. It's the newest in our fleet. We have leased this one from Pan Am until we can take delivery of our own 747s. Our first flight was from New York to Miami on December 20th, 1970. The one we're flying tonight to Miami, continuing on to San Juan, Puerto Rico. We're powered by four Pratt & Whitney JT9D engines, which develop 43,500 pounds of thrust each. Our max takeoff weight today is just over 710,000 pounds, and we have all of our 370 seats are filled. Our flight plan speed today going to Miami is 590 miles per hour. We plan to cruise at an altitude of 37,000 feet.
Roger, Eastern 307 Heavy. The winds are from 250 at 10 knots. You're cleared for takeoff on runway 24 left.
Roger, LA Eastern 307 Heavy. Confirm runway 24 left, and we're ready to roll.
Roger. As the day goes by, feel yourself in it. It's a good day to up and fly away. It's so easy to do. Easton's got the right time.
Hello, folks. Well, we've got a great show for you tonight. Our special guests on tonight's show are two authors of highly acclaimed books on air safety. Actually, I should say three. One you know is a host on our Monday shows, George Jen, but we'll talk about him in just a minute. But first of all, let's introduce Carlene Petit. She's an international airline pilot who is type-rated, has flown and or has instructed on the Boeing 747-400, 747-200, 767, 757, Boeing 737, 727, and the A330 aircraft. Carlene is a 38-year veteran of flying and has worked for Coastal Airways, Evergreen, Premier, Braniff, America West, Guiana, Tower Air, Northwest Airlines, and she's currently based in Los Angeles on the Boeing 777, awaiting training. Carlene lives in Seattle, and she's the mother of three, grandmother of eight, and holds an MBA degree, and is working on her PhD degree in aviation with safety as her focus. It's great to have you with us, Carlene. And golly, I don't know how in the world you got an extra second there.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, just listening to it makes me kind of tired, but you know, when you span it over a lifetime, it's very doable.
Great. Well, you've accomplished so many things and some great work in your book, so we're happy to have you with us tonight. Dorothy, how about introducing Christine?
Christine Negroni is an American aviation and travel writer whose work appears in the New York Times, Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Air and Space, Fortune Magazine, Airways, Runway Girl Network, and other publications. She is the author of two books, Deadly Departure in 2000 and The Crash Detectives Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters in 2016. September 27th of 16, actually, it was published by Penguin Books. Christine is an on-camera contributor for ABC News and writes two blogs, the aviation-themed Flying Lessons and the travel blog Go How, Know How. She is married to Jim Shambari and editor of the New York Times. They have four children.
Okay, let's talk about George Jen for a minute. George Jen was an Eastern pilot for 18 years and flew the Boeing 727, 737, and the Airbus A300. He was also a member of the board of directors and Eastern Master Executive Council Airline Pilots Association for 6 years. That's ALPA, A-L-P-A. He's a member of Eastern Airlines System Board of Adjustment, 10 years founder of Range Magazine, pilot, member of Eastern Airlines Employee Involvement Committee, and other ALPA committees. George had his first novel published in December of 2012, entitled Flying Too Close to the Sun. The second notification book, entitled Final Destination Disaster, What Really Happened to Eastern Airlines, was published on October 1st, 2014. George also worked as an aviation expert witness in several federal lawsuits, including the world's largest Kendler & Kendler. Just as a reminder for everybody listening, I've read George's books, and they are fantastic. And if you haven't read them, you really need to do that. Chuck.
Now let's find out what each of our guests are doing or undertaking at the present. Carlene, you can start with us, and please tell us about your book, both published, or about what could be looking in the future.
Well, you know, what I'm doing is I'm writing a series of aviation thrillers that read like mysteries, and everyone, we just spent 2 days out of a Northwest Aviation Conference, and everyone says, is this fact, or, you know, is this fiction, or is this real? And what I'm doing is I wanted to create awareness of what's going on within our industry from behind the scenes, and things that I think that we need to change. And it's like, how do you change, you know, something that's so global and it's so, you know, I shouldn't even say regulator. We're dealing with major airlines, government, and we don't have a lot of power to do that. So I thought, I'm going to create awareness. So I've taken all these industry issues and woven them into these thrillers. And then in the process, I decided I was going to go back to school and get my PhD in aviation safety. And so during that, I'm starting to learn about safety culture and safety management systems. And SMS is going to be mandated in 2018. And there are many people out there who don't even know what that is, you know, so we're not there yet. So I've taken that and worked it in. And sadly, I should say interesting and sad, a lot of what I'm finding out and working into these novels is really true. And, you know, I started out coming out with what would happen if, and I would write a book on, I would say it would be more proactive safety, seeing something that could happen. And sure enough, in my first book on basically on mental health, how could you break a system before you broke the flight crews? And then 4 or 5 years later, we unfortunately have German Wings, a pilot flying into a mountain. And then I have the next novel is on the A330 and training methodologies and how this training is getting cut short because it's just the opposite. The more complex the aircraft are, they cut the training back. But in reality, we actually need more training because we need to understand when the stuff breaks how to fly an airplane. And sure enough, that novel was with the editor, and Aviana crashes short in San Francisco just because something became disengaged. You know, so that's what I'm doing with the work. And the scary truth is, the more I dig into it, I'm really finding out what is going on behind that curtain within our industry. And we have a lot of work to do, a lot of work. And I also wrote a motivation book, Flight to Success, Be the Captain of Your Life, because I love this business. I love aviation. I love flying. I've had such a blessed career, and I want to share that with these new kids coming into it. So half of me wants to leave it better. So I've inspired them, and I want to leave it better than I found it, and I want to be their advocate. Every new pilot out there that's coming into this, a little fearful, am I going to have a job? Are they going to automate me out of my job? Are we going to put cameras in there? Are they going to cut half my pay? What is this going to look like in 10, 15, 20 years? Well, I am educating myself and building the credentials that I will be an outspoken advocate for that career to keep it going strong, kind of like you guys are doing, keeping Eastern Airlines alive. You know, this is what we need to do. We can't just retire, pack our bags, and leave. And so I've kind of decided that I'm committed the rest of my career and then beyond that to helping this industry from safety and from motivation and to grow it and keep it safer. So that's really what I'm doing with the books. My most recent novel is Flight for Sanity. If anyone wants to read them, Flight for Control is the first one, basically human factors, mental health. Flight for Safety, we go into what's happening within the training environment. Flight Survival, now we go further into next gen and drone operations and start touching on safety culture and SMS. And then Flight for Sanity is probably the scariest out of all of them because, I used to say that just the murder the sex and the sinister plot were fiction. Well, now the sinister plot no longer is fiction. So just the murder and the sex are the fiction parts of my novels, and which is kind of sad, but they're fun. And the most recent one, the comments are coming in. It's only been out for about 2 weeks, and people are reading it, and everybody's saying it's the best. So it's very good news. Like to hear that. So.
Yes, great.
Carlene, I'm going to jump in here. I just started it, and I tell you what, it grabbed me. I couldn't put it down. I'm about a third of the way through, but I'm a slow reader. But golly, Pete, I can just, you know, visualize the scenery that you've created here and the people that you have started out with, and it's going to be a fun read. It really is. And all of it is, I'm sure, is 100% accurate, with the exception of what you just mentioned, that is fiction. So, but it's going to be a good read. I want you now to, before we introduce Christine, and Christine has some books out too, but I'd like for you to tell us, and so our listeners can jot down your URL or your web address or however they can order your books, and before and we'll do it at the end of the show as well, but right now just tell us how can one go about getting your series of books.
Who are you talking to, me, Carlene?
Yes, Carlene.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking to Christina. Oh, they're all on Amazon. We've got paper, hardback, and Kindle. And if you want an autographed copy, you can go to my blog and order them there. And it's CarlenePettit.com. So, and I'm all over social media. I'm LinkedIn, Carlene Pettit. I'm Twitter, Carlene Pettit. So I just utilize my name on everything. So you should be able to find me. But, yeah, go to my blog. I'll send you an autographed copy. And don't tell Amazon, but I undercut them by about $5. So it'll be our secret. It's the pilot price. We have to give that pilot special, right?
There you go. All right. Okay. Chuck, I guess with Christine.
Well, you mentioned it. Christine, what works do you have underway? And please give us a list of your published works or about to be published.
Well, I can't even compare with Carlene with her 7 books and a motivational book and her 8 grandchildren. She's just so busy. She's busy, busy. And I thought I was busy, but she makes me look like I'm doing nothing. I'm standing still. But I do have a book out called The Crash Detectives, and it's a nonfiction book about aviation mysteries. It deals with Malaysia 370, and it compares that disappearance to the disappearance of the Hawaii Clipper back in 1938, and shows how when you look back in history, sometimes things have an awfully remarkable similarity to the present. So my book is about those two disappearances and other mysteries in aviation, and it ends with the mystery of human resiliency, why humans are so important in aviation, you know, what we bring to the table in spite of the fact that we're so fallible, what we can rely on the human to do that the machine and the computer cannot do. So it's a nonfiction book. I hope it reads like fiction, but it's all true. And that's my most recent book, which is it's been published in the United States since September. I'm leaving to London next week because it will be published in the UK for the first time, and then it will be published in Portuguese and Brazil this summer. So it's sort of hopefully taking off around the world. That's my goal.
Excellent.
Your husband now is with the New York Times. Does that allow you to keep your works right up there in the New York Times?
I wish. You know, I was not reviewed by the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal gave me an unbelievably beautiful, fantastic review, and I threatened to marry the man who wrote it, but then he pointed out to my attention that both he and I were married, so I couldn't. But my husband does work for the New York Times, and I write for the New York Times, but it didn't seem to have, you know, any effect. And for that, I blame Donald Trump, because he basically was dominating the headlines at the time, and still is, of course, but was dominating the headlines when my book came out. And as they say, took all the oxygen out of the room. So I didn't get reviewed in the New York Times, but in spite of that, I have gotten a lot of good reviews, and the book is doing well. I think we're going into a second printing, and it's sold out within the first 3 weeks in Australia and New Zealand. I'm hoping it does the same thing in England. So we'll see. Tell all your friends. Buy multiple copies.
Now, how can they go about getting your book? The same thing.
Well, my
book,
like Carlene's books, are all on Amazon. They're at Indiegogo, which is another website for independent bookstores, BarnesandNoble.com. Any place you want to buy a book, you can go to your local bookstore.
Okay, well, I guess we're – George, you're up to bat here. It's about the same question, so to speak. How about your published works and things that are about to be published? Let our people out there in Radio Land know what's going on with you.
Okay, well, as you know, my memoir, Final Destination Disaster, What Really Happened to Eastern Airlines, was published a little over 2 years ago. And like Carlene and Christine's book, it's doing very well. It is a memoir, as you know. As our listeners know, I was involved in a lot of different episodes leading up to the sale and the subsequent destruction of Eastern Airlines by the Texas Air Corporation, and that's pretty much chronicled in the book, and where it led me was somewhere I never dreamed it would, but it ultimately led me down to South America. And my first book, the novel, Flying Too Close to the Sun, I actually had a problem with my publisher on that book. He owed me some money, and I guess he was experiencing some financial problems. And so I told him that I'd like to get the rights of the book reverted back to me in exchange for what he owed me, and he did that. So I now have a literary agent who is out there attempting to sell the book to a larger publishing house. I have a couple of other books. One is finished. Neil knows about that one. I forwarded him chapter one of it and the introduction. It's more of a comedy book, and I've just been holding off on publishing that. But I don't know. It's pretty tough to keep up with Carlene and Christine, who I've read Christine's book. I have not read Carlene's books, any of them yet, but I will. And I can tell you that Christine's book, her latest book, The Crash Detectives, I couldn't put it down. It was excellent. And I wrote a critique of it on Barnes & Noble, of course, on their website, and gave it the highest rating that I could, and because it deserved it. And that's about it for me.
Thank you,
well, thank
George.
Thank you very much. We can open it up to some discussion now. Neil, you had something you want to talk about?
No, I thought I heard, was that Christine's voice?
Well, I just was thanking George for the write-up on Barnes & Noble. That's very sweet. You know, when somebody reads your book and then writes a review, that's like, you know, you get a star next to your name in heaven for that kind of activity. Carlene, Carlene's saying, that's right. And Carlene's got lots of reviews. I just did a little search. She's up in the hundreds on her reviews. So good, well done there.
Well, let me ask you this question. I have a question here about writing a book as technical as aviation disasters and research that you guys do. Do you have a limited audience there that would pick up and read a book like this? Would it be, I don't know, what's your thoughts about the folks that you're trying to get to read your book? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And you spend so much time in writing these books. And, George, you too are writing a book about Eastern Airlines. I mean, Eastern Airlines folded its wings 20-plus years ago, and yet I guess people still find it interesting.
You know, I think the Internet has enabled a lot of – I didn't mean to just jump in there, George, but I think that – tell me if you – agree. I think the internet's enabled a lot of people to connect into their little, you know, whatever their niche of interest is. So my first book came out in 2000, and you know, the internet was around, of course, but we didn't use it the way we do now with social media. And so, you know, people, I think, knew about my book. It was much more widely reviewed, but still it got to the general public. And of the general public, I think it's a small percentage who are interested in air disaster books. But now my book has come out, you know, in the era of social media and, you know, and the ability to reach out to people. And my book has been much, much, much more successful in a much shorter period of time because I go directly to those people who I know have an interest in either aviation or aviation safety or mysteries and that sort of thing. So I think it, you know, it's sort of the yin and the yang of it is that you can, you know, it is a smaller group that's interested. This isn't a beach book, but yet, you know, I can find all the people. It's much easier to find the people who are interested in this subject. You know, I'd rather talk to your show than, you know, Howard Stern, because your show is going to be people who are more likely to go out and buy this book because this is their subject,
yeah.
You see? So that's, you know, that's the upside of it. I mean, do you find that to be the case, George?
Yes, I do. And of course, my book was very, very, was impacted a lot by Dan Futrell and Isaac Stoner and Peter Frick Wright, who went down to La Paz just last May and, you know, went up to the Flight 980 crash site. And then Peter Frick Wright wrote a lengthy article in Outside Magazine, which really generated a lot of interest and a lot of sales of the book.
Right,
And rightfully so. And I believe Peter called me up a couple of weeks ago. I believe they're going to do a follow-up in Outside Magazine also on their trip. So that certainly helped a lot. And
look,
you know,
then that expanded your market because it's not just aviation people. It's the adventure seekers and it's the outdoors people who might not otherwise have thought they'd be interested in your book. So that sort of expands you into a different niche, which is great.
It is.
And
it really
Carlene, helps. how about you and your books and what's your thoughts about this?
Well, you know, I being that I have just the fiction novels, oh my gosh, it's snowing in Seattle right now. I'm sorry, I just looked out the window. We're having a snowstorm in Seattle, which is very unusual for this time of year. No, you know what, I've noticed that people do come through my table and they say, there's a lot of people looking for nonfiction. They want your books. There's these aviation conferences that it's kind of difficult to go to if it's not in your hometown because you got to pack all your books and go and sit there all day and talk to people, but it's so much fun. But there are a ton of people out there. Everyone comes in. They want to know what's going on. There's aviation buffs. They're having one up in Alaska that gets 50,000 people coming through, and it's the first weekend of May. But what happened with mine is I created this first novel, and then I created the second novel, and then I started the PhD. So I thought I kind of shifted hats a little bit, and I thought, okay, this will be the time to get the easier book out, the motivation book, and so I can have something at the conference next year. And everyone came through, and they were mad at me because they wanted a Darby book, and they said, "Where's Darby?" And it was so funny because I didn't realize that they had fallen in love with one of the characters, and then I kind of got in trouble. So now I promised everyone Darby will be back, you know, so now I have to do a Darby book every year, but it's been fun writing, and I'm trying to convert those technical readers over to realize that in fiction, there's a lot of truth in fiction, and now that I see, you know, I'll read a book, one of my favorite authors is Robert Dagoni, and he's an attorney, and so he writes law, you know, with a law theme to it. And I'll read something and go, wow, that's fascinating. I go look it up, and it's true. And so I think that, you know, there's such a nice balance between the both. But for you authors to be able to take nonfiction and create something that's entertaining and reads well is such a talented art. You know, I hope to be able to get that way because at the end of mine, I want to write one of those books on the truth and the essence of what's going on, you know, the truth behind my series. So, but it is an art. It's a skill. Sometimes I feel like a little bit of a cheat because I get plot points thrown at me and I just have to work them in and develop my characters and you know, work it that way. But, yeah, it's fun for any author. You know you put a lot of work into it, but it's such a passion. It's almost a release, you know, and thank you, you know, for your compliments on what I do. But it's kind of like I have more fun creating my little world and my novels than I do watching TV. So, my husband's out watching the sports, and I'm in here working on my book. So, yeah. So, it's really nice when your work is passion, kind of like flying. It's like the first time I got an airplane, they're going to pay me to do this, so.
Yeah. my favorite author, I like American history, or history period. And Herman Walk takes actual events in American history and war, especially World War II, and he turned it and created, the Winds of War series. I think there were two books that he did. And what do you call that? It's fictional characters with...
Historical fiction.
Historical fiction.
I'm glad you guys are... There, I'm still trying to figure out a little bio about myself. But at any rate, it's great that you create a book of interest and people can move right along in the book, and I'm sure they have questions. Is this actual? Is this factual? Did this happen? And I want to ask this question. That's my little blurb there, but I want to ask this question. When an aircraft accident happens, a disaster happens, what do you do? Christine, especially you, because you're news reporting, you're right live on national media coverage. And how do you get involved in this type of investigation?
Well, in my case, I've done investigations from two different perspectives, both as a journalist. I covered the crash of TWA Flight 800 for CNN, and then for ABC, I covered the disappearance of Malaysia Flight 370. So that's that's basically a public investigation. I'm working with the material in front of me that's coming out with the daily briefing and whatever information I can, scare up from my contacts and, information facts that come out. And I'll give you a quick example of that. You may remember that about 6 weeks ago, there was an airplane flying from Bolivia to Colombia. It had a Brazilian soccer team on it. And the plane ran out of fuel on landing at Medellin, just short of the runway in Medellin. So I read about that. I woke up to it and heard it on the news and started looking around on the Internet. So I'm sitting in my pajamas in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, just sort of looking around on the Internet. Now, remember when it first happened, nobody knew why the plane landed. That he'd reported to air traffic control that he had a power loss, a total power failure. But I looked at the route map just basically from FlightAware, and then I looked at the model aircraft, and then I thought, this doesn't seem like a plane that could go that far. That's a 4.5-hour flight. So I was just Googling the specs on the aircraft. And by, an hour later, I'd written a blog post saying, looks to me like this plane might have run out of fuel. It's beyond the range of this aircraft. So, of course, we know 2 days later that's exactly what happened. But I am not telling you this by way of saying, aren't I clever? What I'm saying is there's an awful lot of information out there, and all you have to do is put one and one and one together, and you can figure out, in some cases, what should be the next step in the investigation. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying that you can sort of see the direction things are going in. So that's the way you do it, from the public, from the outsider's perspective. Then I also worked as an air crash investigator for Kreindler and Kreindler, which is the law firm that George, in fact, I think that's how I met you, George, is through Kreindler and Kreindler. But they represent families who have lost someone in an air accident, and their investigations, basically look and see, well, what's the NTSB or whoever the investigative body, what are they doing, and are there things that they're not looking at that they should look at? And so in that respect, I go out and I hire experts and I have them go over the public evidence and some of the information that's available to the family. And we, sort of ask questions. We do our own investigation. Those are both very different from what the NTSB does, obviously, because the NTSB has hands-on access to everything. But, that's the sort of the sweeping answer to your question.
Do you have any problems getting information from the NTSB? I mean, just when do you jump in there and start contacting them and asking for more questions to be answered?
Oh, sometimes they're very difficult to deal with, but I'd say lately that hasn't been the case. During TWA Flight 800, which was 1996, so you got to cut them some slack, it was a while ago, during that time, there were the press department was very sort of clicky. You know, they had the reporters they wanted to talk to, and other people were sort of frozen out. So they can be very difficult. Now, over the years, they've gotten very savvy, and they're terrific in the way they deal with the public now because they use social media. So everybody on Twitter can see the latest thing that the NTSB is releasing. Now, they've taken some heat from that, too, from during Asiana 214. They took some heat because the chairman, Deb Hirschman, was tweeting some information that she got, which she is entitled to do as the public representative of the air safety investigators, but ALPA said that it was the first time they were using Twitter this way, and ALPA was arguing that they were releasing information that prejudged the investigation. In fact, they were not, but they were not used to seeing the NTSB distribute information in that way, and I think it alarmed them. But the other thing I will say is when I worked at Kreindler and Kreindler, I remember we had a case in which we wanted to take a look at a propeller. We wanted to have it examined. And the NTSB damned if they hadn't lost it. And we never did get that propeller. So sometimes, yes, you know, they do stuff that like any other person screws up on a job. They didn't do a very good thing, and they lost this, what was for us, a critical piece of evidence.
And George knows that very well, don't you, George?
I sure do, Neil.
Well, I've been hogging all the questions here. Any of our hosts and our listeners, because our board is completely lit up tonight.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I've investigated on the Internet two crashes. One was recently, and one was back in 99. Korean Air cargo flight 8509 crashed on takeoff, mainly because one of the instruments, the INU, failed, and they said that they had repaired it on the ground, but unfortunately it did not respond as they were taking off on the captain's side, but the co-pilot side was functioning, so they felt that it was going to make it. One of the things that I ran into with these two investigations, and I guess it's because they're Asian Airlines, maybe I'm wrong, but what happened here is the captain, he kept banking the airplane to the left, and it didn't show up that he was doing this incorrect, and for some reason, the co-pilot didn't say anything. Until it got to where the flight engineer called out the word bank, which was supposed to alert the crew that you're having a problem here. And there was no response from the captain, and he continued banking the airplane, and he kept going to the left, which is obviously the plane has so many feet of wing. And finally, the wing just dug into the ground, and the aircraft just came apart at about 300 knots. Of course, unfortunately, nobody survived. And after this investigation, United Kingdom Air Accident Investigation Branch issued a recommendation to Korean Air to revise its training program and company culture to promote a more free atmosphere between the captain and the first officer. Since then, Korean Air has not had a single fatality crash since this accident, and one in 1999. Now, I would like to get your opinion. Have you, in your investigation, both of you actually, found this to be true in the Asian culture?
Well, I'll jump in with that. Absolutely, it's the case. And as I recall that accident, there was a real imbalance. I mean, the captain was highly, highly experienced, and the first officer was, you know, had just out of qualifying on the flight. The details aren't clear with me, but I do remember there was a real experience imbalance in the crew there. But even
That's
not,
correct.
You know, Yeah, notwithstanding that, though, that, you know, this whole, I'm on sort of a campaign about this because the whole notion of crew resource management, of course, is that, you know, you remove the imbalance and everyone has the opportunity to speak up. But what's being discovered now, we're 40 years into CRM, 30 or 40 years into CRM, and we still see accidents like this happening right down in the accident I just talked about in Latin America. The first officer didn't speak up when he saw that the captain was departing on a flight where they didn't even have enough fuel to make it. And Asiana 214, where the captain did not do a go-around, even though he was on an unstabilized approach and should have done a go-around, and the training captain did not correct him. We see these events continuing to happen. And my feeling is, at this point, I think that the aviation community needs to relook at whether you can tell cultures to throw these cultural restrictions aside and do it like the Westerners, because to some respect, it's unrealistic. A Japanese culture, you know, that where you do not speak back to someone who is your senior, but I'm going to get into this seat in this cockpit and I'm going to forget that, hasn't worked. And we can bang our heads against the wall about that for another 40 years, or we can maybe try a different approach. If it works in Western culture, great, and appears to be. But in other countries, in other cultures, Latin American culture, Middle Eastern culture, Asian culture, not so much.
One of the other questions I had in mind, and our little group has talked this over for years, and consequently, it's based on the idea that we're now coming out with autonomous cars, and eventually, since we have so much autopilot systems and the airplane, eventually, are they going to take the pilot out of the cockpit?
They are definitely going for that route and heading that way. And I think the only thing that's holding them back right now is security. They have not mastered the security. But what I see happening is this induced pilot shortage. I mean, we're growing airlines or buying airplanes like crazy. We're having a lot of retirement on the top end, and we can't get pilots into this. And what do? We create this 1,500-hour rule. So I think what's going to happen, and I'm going to try and keep that, I'm going to try and be an advocate to stop it, but I can see we're going to get to a point where technology is going to get good enough, and they're going to say, okay, the four-person augmented crew, technology is so good, we're having a pilot shortage, so we have to, economics is most important, we're going to go down to three pilots, and the three crew are going to go down to two pilots. The two crew are eventually going to go to one. And I never realized how close and where they were headed with that until I got into the research and started seeing what was going on. And I had a discussion with an engineer who came out, and he said, we don't even need you anymore. He said, it won't be long. And I said, yeah, I know something that I can do that your autopilot can't do. And I said, I can land a 20-knot crosswind. And he laughed, and he looked at me and he says, but we're going to fix that. So, you know, it's like right now we can land a little bit further parameters than automation, but they're working on it, and it's not unrealistic. It's not going to be one of those futuristic things. It's going to be very, it's going to be reality. But, go ahead.
No, finish.
I was going to say, in alignment with that about pilots not speaking up, is because our training is getting cut so short. I don't think that our pilots really have an in-depth understanding of the aircraft. We're teaching ourselves at home on a flash drive. We don't go to ground school anymore. We don't have a group of people that we can discuss with if we don't understand something. And we may misinterpret it on our own, and then that's our first learned, and that's what we think. And so we're kind of doing this on our own. So when the systems break or something's wrong, I think a lot in the Western culture, we're going to be seeing pilots sitting there not speaking out because they don't really understand or know what's going on. And if the captain with that experience is letting us go, it must be okay. And I can really see that we're going to be going down that path, you know, not too long in the future.
Well, you know, and when you said that, Carlene, when you said that the person you were talking to said, the guy who was promoting automated flight said to you, well, you said, I can land in a 20-knot crosswind, and he said, well, we'll fix that. I thought, yeah, he's talking to you. You're not going to fix that in the airplane. He's going to make sure that you can't land in a 20-knot crosswind. You know why? Because the more you rely on automation, the flabbier your skills get. That is already proven. And so, you know, this business about the first officer is not exactly sure whether the captain's doing the right thing or not, because his flying skills are flabby and he doesn't recognize that the captain's flying skills are flabby, and that's absolutely already happening. It's already happening. So here's the thing. So that convinces the folks who want to automate aircraft even more, let's continue to make pilots who have deteriorating skills. Let's continue to do the thing that's making them unable to be on their, you know, ahead of their aircraft all the time. It's a death spiral. It's essentially a death spiral.
Did you read Flight for Sanity already?
I did not read Carlene, I haven't read any of your books, but
it's
now I've just ordered three of them.
I'm absolutely joking, because that's kind of the setup that I'm looking at. You know, why are we creating this world? It's almost like we're intentionally creating this world of skill deficit pilots. We know what's happening, and we know it, and everybody knows it, but they're not asking why, and they're not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
And because I think that they're going to just say, okay, we're just going to create these pilots who are going to crash. It's human error, but look at our automation. You know, and you get a public perception that as long as you have automation, there's not going to be human error. Well, I'm sorry. If somebody's on the ground with an automated aircraft in the sky, he's still going to have human error. It just is what it is.
It's a different kind of human error, because you see, those computers don't spring from the head of Zeus. They are designed by humans. And the same error-prone humans that fly airplanes create software and create the interface and create the machine-computer interface. So the same, you know, there's the same fallible human, only this time they're programming the airplane.
And
we're all looking to be the Jetsons.
Yeah, Dorothy, I'm going to put Dorothy in there. She's trying to get a question in.
I'm sorry,
well,
Dorothy.
That's okay. The thing that I was going to say is, being a computer person, I know how computers crash all the time. I can't imagine a plane being up and not having somebody there. The what if case it does, because everyone knows it does happen. And that's what the problem is. They're going to put all of these non-piloted planes up there and say, well, they're all computerized, but there's every computer that's up and started out, it always has coordinates that aren't quite right, things that won't work, so they make it a little better and they'll send you an update and they'll fix it a little bit more and fix it a little bit more. You buy any kind of a program, you know how long it takes for that program to be absolutely secure. It's not, because there's always something that needs more tweaking that they haven't done. Well, you put that in a plane, you're up in the air, what do you do then if there's nobody around to take care of it and get it down?
What about a hacker?
Correct.
I believe.
And then there's cyber threats. Correct.
Well,
yeah.
I think the one factor that's being overlooked here completely is the bottom line factor. That's why they're doing all of this, is to enhance the bottom line, to do away with a lot of the labor problems that are currently out there with pilots. But I believe that it's all in order to make more, earn more dollars. I mean, there's no other reason. There's no good reason for it other than that. If you think about it, that the bottom line is the bottom line.
Just to interject something, George, one of the things that's causing the pilot shortage, which I read this article was, because I keep up with my military career that I had, is that the pilots in the services now are not coming out and joining the airlines, because the military realized that these guys were quitting the military and going and getting higher paid jobs. So now the government has issued, starting about almost 7 or 8 years ago, to start giving these pilots, these very experienced pilots, higher salaries to keep them in, and bonuses. And that's contributing somewhat to the pilot shortage that you guys see now. You're not getting military pilots as much as you used to.
Well, that's what I said.
Yeah. And I think the military pilots, there's not many going in the military as they were, because if they want to fly, you're not necessarily guaranteed a flight slot any longer. Your flight slot could be operating a drone. And so 50% of those flight pilots going into the military may not even ever see the inside of an airplane.
Yeah, a lot of the drone pilots are not even officers. They're non-coms.
Right.
And they're halfway around the world. But they know how to run video games. They've been doing it all their lives. And that's what they're
I'm just saying, you know, it's like, you know, this is going to be the next level of terrorism. And you can plan, this will be like book novel 7. It's two novels out. But you know, as long as we can keep the terrorists off the aircraft, and I keep them out and close that door and keep them off my airplane, for all intents and purposes, is going to be safe flying. But could you imagine 100,000, you know, thousands of airplanes in the sky, and they're all being operated on the ground in a big warehouse? All it takes is one person to open that door, and the entire sky, the entire industry gets taken out, you know, every airplane in one swoop. And
but they may not even need to enter that door, Carlene. They can hack in there. And
right.
so, and
exactly.
that really is the fly-by-wire threat. Truly, is a cyber threat more than pilot complacency, because that's a human by human. But the cyber threat, it's already there. They're already able to do these things. So, and I think that they're way behind. I mean, the aviation industry is way behind in keeping up with that.
You know,
sounds like tri-rail.
Tonight. Tri-rail, go ahead, Don.
It sounds like tri-rail is going to be the way to go.
I don't know. There's been an awful lot of railroad accidents lately.
Well,
I don't know.
Wow, what an eye-opener.
I'd love to give a little blurb for John Nance's new book, Lockout. It's actually an A330 that is addressing exactly what we're talking about. It's just somebody put something on the airplane to take control over it. He did a very good job of it. And it kind of will open your eyes to what the potential is for one aircraft. You know, it on all of them. Yeah,
he's so great.
They made a movie about
really
that when they drove the president's airplane by fly-by-wire. Some terrorist group took over the airplane. So not too far behind, I guess.
Yep.
It's the same guy that landed on the taxiway.
Harrison Ford, right.
Was he in it? Oh, wow.
Harrison. And I think
poor Harrison, but I think if Harrison looks around a little bit, he's going to find that there's been three major airlines who have done the same thing. Pilots
actually have landed
on the taxiway, and they're still working. So
yeah.
They're still flying.
That's still happening?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Landing on the wrong runway or a wrong airport?
Absolutely. He just
did
it.
Or on the taxiway. Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, wow.
And
I remember that happening down in Miami. They, instead of landing on Miami International, they landed at a smaller airport up north that the Navy had. It was a Navy base that had folded up, but they still used it for small aircraft, but they still had long runways.
Well, I'm old enough now that I'm old enough and retired that I can tell my experience. The first officer saved me. I would have landed at Davis Montham instead of the one down south of it.
Tucson?
Yeah, Tucson. Uh-huh. I couldn't even see how old I am. I can't even think now. But, I was lined up beautifully, and I thought I had the right profile all the way down to landing at Davis Montham. Or to Tucson. Instead, I was lined up for Davis Montham.
In that cockpit, obviously.
Yeah.
If your first officer spoke up, good for him.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know what resulted out of that, but Carlene, you mentioned SMS. That's a new acronym or letters. What do you talk about SMS? Or maybe Christine, you do.
SMS, its simplest version, it's safety management systems, and they've been doing this over in Europe for years. kudos for Alaska Airlines, because they were trying to implement this probably 10, 15 years ago, and the FAA couldn't even help them do it. And now it's going to be mandated. It's actually, there's a mandate out January 2018. So we're now within a year of its mandate, and still, you know, we're still at the square one at this. But SMS envision crew resource management for the corporation. And what we're trying to do with it is to tear down this hierarchy of structures and these silos where, you know, it's a chain of command. You got to go into the bottom and, and they shut you down right there. And open up and make it a flatter organization where every employee is able to come forward. And the components, they have like safety policy, it's about safety policy. It's about safety assurance, safety risk management, and under safety assurance, making sure that people, they have a good reporting culture. Safety culture is huge under this. You need to have a reporting culture, a flexible culture, a learn culture, adjust. And you really need to, it's just like if you had your flight deck where we want everyone's information to come together because we're going to make better decisions that way. And if somebody sees something wrong, we can do it. And you know what? We're not there yet. I'm looking at some of these airlines, and they do not have a safety culture. This is a huge, huge theme in my book, Flight for Sanity, because as we spoke last time, you can't fire pilots for reporting safety or making too many ASRs or, that's bad. But you can pull them for other things. And they're utilizing German wings as a tactic to do this. And it's just if you have an airline that does that because somebody has reported safety, you don't have a safety culture to support SMS. And SMS is going to be a really good thing. I was looking through all those accidents and trying to see what areas could we have applied SMS processes to that. And almost everywhere. You know, look at who was it? Was it TWA that lost the A330 or the A300 that lost its tail because they slammed on the rudder? Remember out in New York?
No, that was American.
American, that's right, American Airlines. So they slammed on the rudder. Well, what they found out after that investigation, like 2-3 years later, that they had an instructor who said, no, you can't. They were teaching it in the sim. The pilot who did this, a captain the trip before, had told him, no, you can't be doing it. He says, no, this is what they're teaching us in the simulator. A Czech airman in the simulator said, this can't be right. So he wrote to his chief pilot, and he wrote to Boeing. Granted, wasn't in a Boeing aircraft, but he had a connection there, and they wrote a letter back. So all this documentation came out like 5 years after this horrific accident, that if SMS had been in place and they really truly had true communication, risk mitigation processes in place to address these things when they came forward, that never would have happened. And that's what SMS is all about. It's just to mitigate the risk and make sure it doesn't happen. And I am just sighing that it's, I have this huge sigh and a huge disappointment because it's just not going to, we're not, our airlines aren't there with the safety culture to support this right now.
Well, we got a little extra noise here.
SMS is another Six Sigma in the air.
Yeah.
We've got so many numbers here on my board. I'm only allowed 25 on my board that I can see, but others are listening, I'm sure. And if any of our listeners would like to ask Christine, Carlene, or George any questions, please do so. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, am I on?
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, this is Jim Wright. I'm a friend of Carlene's, and we've been doing kind of a novel experiment combining aviation with the maritime industry. And the question I was going to ask Carlene is whether you notice in the airline industry a decrease in the number of guys that are competent at hand flying, which would be kind of similar to unassisted ship handling in our business. Because as these guys disappear from the scene, then the likelihood of having realistic training in that area starts going along with them.
Great question.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they came out, the Office Inspector General came out in 2015 or 16 and said, they came out and said pilots lack flying skills. And it's true. And I had asked a Czech airman once, why aren't the pilots hand flying these aircraft? And he said, because they lack confidence. They're afraid. And they're afraid they lack confidence and they just don't have the skill to do it. Or the lack of understanding is what he said. And wow. And actually, this is what I'm working on in my research to try and find out. We know this problem exists. The pilots don't have the skill. But, you know, you think, oh, just disengage automation like on the Airbus. You disengage the autopilot. It's not like a normal airplane that used to fly over at Eastern. It's still, there's computers working behind the scenes. And so mm-hmm. it's a lot easier to just push the button, you know. And a serious story, a Czech airman told a captain who was asking too many questions, stop asking questions if you want to get through this program. Be the monkey, push the button, and get the banana. And that's how they're training. So, so it is a problem, yeah.
Microphones are open, folks. Wow, what a discussion tonight. This is, I think, one of the best programs we've ever presented. Thank you so much for all that you have contributed. And you both have been on our show in the past. And golly, Pete, this little round table discussion here, I wish we had television. We could televise it. But what kind of interest do you guys, especially Christine, you being in the media, in the TV and the and printed media, what kind of interest do you find people wanting knowledge about what's happening and you know, wanting information about these future of commercial aviation?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. There's been a huge, huge increase in the number of people flying around the world, obviously, as economies have improved in places where they didn't traditionally fly. More people are taking to the skies, and, of course, that's, you know, in the light of the pilot shortage that Carlene and George were talking about, that's obviously exacerbating it. We've got places, airlines coming up in Indonesia and the South Pacific and obviously the Asian countries that are all of a sudden, you know, have a desperate need for pilots in a culture where there is no general aviation or very little general aviation. So they have to push these pilots through from in ab initio training, sending them over to the United States or to the UK, and turning them into pilots where they then will get in the, you know, in the right seat with, you know, maybe a couple of hundred hours. So, you know, these are all sort of issues that come about. Then you have the automation issues, the one that you know, that we've all talked about in this on this program tonight. But what's happening on the passenger side and the airline side is airlines have started to make money, you know, reliably making money. People want to fly. There's fare wars. Norwegian Air just announced that it's going to start flying out of Providence, Rhode Island, Stewart, Hartford. These are small airports that are now going to have transatlantic flights. So you see, like, everything is converging into a state of chaos, uncertainty. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. And yet, when I say to, you know, my client newspapers of ABC or New York Times, listen, you know, there's a crisis on the horizon. There's just not a lot of appetite for it because the interest of the general flying public is this: how much do I have to pay to check my bag?
Yep.
How long do I have to wait for TSA? You know, will I get a bigger seat? You know, the issues are just very much personal, my flight experience. There is no big picture interest in aviation. So it's hard to do what I do because aviation safety is not a sexy subject. But if I were to say, you know, laptops are now going to, or I don't know, think of something, now you can get your in-flight entertainment on your laptop, that would be a story. So there's a very distorted view. I think we have a distorted view of what the safety issues are and, you know, what the news issues are. On the other hand, I get that, you know, I know what stories are going to become clickbait and what stories are not. So it's a tough industry to write about for that reason, because what's sexy is not necessarily what's important.
Well, that's great.
Well,
that,
one,
uh, George, go
you know,
ahead.
One of my favorite subjects, Christine, is the ETOPS program. And, you know, we started out with four engines over water. We went to three. Now we're down to two. And it's all done for economic reasons. And in my humble opinion, it's not a matter of if one goes into the drink, but when it's going to happen due to that reason, with only two engines on practically every new aircraft that's built today.
Yes, and no, I agree with you, and I, because you've read my book, I think the lithium-ion battery-powered Dreamliner is a ticking time bomb, and that's an accident waiting to happen. But there, you know, and though I've written about it, that section of my book about the Dreamliner battery is probably the most in-depth analysis of the decisions Boeing made in putting lithium-ion batteries on that airplane that's been published. I'm sorry, it sounds a little immodest, but I just haven't, you know, I had to research it, and there just wasn't a lot of information out there. That, you know, that decision made, you know, and then the FAA said you will not have smoke, you will not have a thermal runaway on these batteries, and then when they started having them, just basically rescinded that restriction. So that we now know that Dreamliner batteries are failing in flight, and there is no counting of them, there's no investigation of them. You can only say, well, sooner or later we're going to have a problem. Then all of a sudden everyone will care. But the information's out there. The information's out there.
You're correct, but nobody wants to put it out. It's there, but it's not out there for public consumption.
It's complex.
Only those of us who, you know, who follow it or are in the know, for lack of a better expression, realize what the dangers truly are.
Yeah. Now, I mean, we have had this sort of grim conversation, which, of course, is fun and thrilling for us. But truly, I mean, I do want to step back as someone who flies all the time, and I know you guys too, do too. People look at you and say, well, aren't you afraid? And the fact of the matter is, I am not, because aviation safety is a finely oiled machine. Despite all the things we've talked about, truly, aviation is the safest way to move around. And it's probably because of these kinds of conversations within the industry that it is that way. But I really don't want to sound like a Jeremiah on the subject of aviation safety, because I think it's remarkably safe.
I don't disagree with that, but the question I think that should be placed out there is, could it be even safer? That's what should be asked.
Yes.
Well, while we're talking about safer or less safe, is flying getting safer or less safe today compared with 10 or 20 years ago? What do you think?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question. I mean, our aircraft and equipment are getting better. And so they're going to be safer. If you look at the early crashes, most of them were equipment failure and then human failure. And now, you know, the problem is, if you have the equipment failure, if we have highly trained pilots who know what they're doing, that's not going to be an issue, because equipment is so, aircraft are so, you know, well built. Even with a failure, you can handle it as long as the pilot is qualified. Now, if the airplanes aren't going to fail, And we're seeing that they're running a lot more seamlessly, you know, smoothly, then you can have pilots who just know how to push the buttons. Everything's going to be fine. But the problem I can see in the future is, if we don't keep those pilots, teach them what they really need to know and keep that understanding, you know, we may run them through training today, but in 20 years when that airplane breaks, will they have the understanding and ability to deal with it? And that's when those two come together, when the airplane breaks at the same time you have somebody who is not prepared. You know, we've gone from competency to proficiency. And with AQP, Advanced Qualification Procedures, we now only have to make pilots proficient. They don't necessarily have to be competent. And that's enabling us to shorten the footprint. And, you know, with technology, there's so many things that we can do. You know, just like teaching. Okay, we all know that you learn better if you have repetition, you have feedback, and you learn the right thing right the first time. And all of us who have gone into a classroom, you know, how much do you learn from the other people? Somebody poses a question, you get in a discussion. That's where I learn. I can read a book, but I don't really learn until I'm interactive with other people and, you know, their insights, and we bring it all together. So we're losing that. You know, my doctoral course is online, and it's a worldwide program at Embry-Riddle, but it is designed that we all come together 24/7, it's open, and we get in these fabulous discussions you know, around the world with everyone and beating this type of questions up. And why couldn't we do that with airline training? Why couldn't we make a virtual classroom? The technology is there. So instead of me sitting at home with my flash drive trying to read how, you know, FADEC works, if I don't understand something, I can get into my virtual classroom with all these other pilots and say, hey, guys, you know, kind of like what we're doing right now. You can do that online, and the technology is there, and it wouldn't really cost any more money, but they just haven't, you know, they haven't gone that route. You know, it's, they're just staying at this, they're just cutting back and not thinking outside the box. And it really wouldn't be that much. It's not like it would be that much more money, but the benefit would be so great. Our industry is very safe, but unfortunately, it's not very proactive. It's always been reactive. And, you know, just like Air France and that pitot tube problem, there are airplanes, hundreds of those incidents that occurred around the world with that same pitot tube that the pilots lost all instruments. So they knew it was a known problem, but no pilot had ever had this experience, fatigued, in bad weather, in the middle of night, in the middle of a storm, you know, inexperienced, and all of a sudden they're rocking and rolling without visual conditions and grab that stick. You know, nobody ever expected that, but we knew the problem was there. It just never manifested in the crash. So have, with safety management systems and proactive thinking, the first time one of those problems comes in, somebody sitting at the table says, wait a minute, what if a pilot doesn't know how to handle this? What if they just react because they're in the clouds and the plane's rocking and rolling, they grab the stick and then they lose all orientation? Okay, then somebody would say, you know what, we've got to fix the problem. And if somebody would have thought that at the time, every single person on that plane would be alive today. You know, and that's a sad thing. So we need to, you know, get safety management systems so we're thinking proactively, and when somebody brings something forward, we need to think about it. You know, and it's all about money. So it's, okay, what are the chances it's going to happen versus how much is it going to cost to fix it, kind of thing, you know. But that's where we need to get our heads and our thinking is, what could happen? And if it could happen, then why don't we fix it ahead of time?
Well, Carlene and Christine, my question is, where can one go to, you know, discussions like we've had tonight? Just a great conversation, really great. I'm an old person, and I'm learning. I learn about so many things that you guys said tonight. I mean, acronyms and so forth. You know, I had a problem with that in commercial aviation acronyms. And where can one go to listen to programs? Are they available on television or radio?
Sadly, no. I mean, there's a lot of podcasts out there that you get into different discussions on topics. I guess you could just start searching out the different podcasts. But
You're down there. Are you down there in Florida? Did you not say you were down there in Florida?
I'm real close Embry-Riddle.
Yeah.
Well,
there you go. So Embry-Riddle has a speaker series, and if I am not mistaken, it's once a week. Now, they're not always aviation because, you know, I think they're trying to expand the minds of their aviation students, like the whole world is in airplanes. But they do very frequently have these discussions. I'm going to be down there doing one of the speaker lectures in the fall. But go onto their website and look at speaker series. And if I am not mistaken, it's broadcast on the web, so you don't actually have to go. You could watch it live or maybe on a tape delay. So, and they, you know, and there's lots of interesting people there. I mean, I know that there's going to have a woman who wrote a book about aviation in Antarctica, and I saw that, and I'm like, wow, I want to hear that. So, and I would imagine that a lot of the aviation colleges have that. And what Carlene was talking about with her PhD program, they probably have forums there, don't they, Carlene?
Well, you know what? I love going on. You can log on, and I don't know if it's open for. I'm sure it's open to public. But every time somebody's defending their dissertation, and we've got a lot of doctoral students who are going through, you can actually log in to an Embry-Riddle doctoral students and watch them from your computer.
That would be
fascinating. It's
fascinating.
You learn a ton of stuff, and it's all research based, going, you know, for future aviation needs. So that's really a good source.
Yeah, that does sound good.
Hey, I graduated from Embry-Riddle back in 1957, I think it was. That was a long time ago, Carlene. That was in Miami, Florida, when they didn't have an Embry-Riddle or Arizona campus and around the world campuses, I guess, now. And
I was just getting out of high school then.
Yeah, hey, okay.
They were actually starting their school in an old World War II hospital.
Well, in the chicken coop in the aviation building on 27th Avenue. Yeah, and it was a great course.
You know, with the FAA requiring more hours, are we getting more experienced pilots to come into the aviation, commercial aviation, now that we've asked them to go out and get more hours?
No, actually, you know what? I think it's had a reverse effect. Because look at it this way. If you have hours don't make necessary experience, and we're having a pilot shortage. So now before this happened, if you had 100 100 pilots that you could choose from, and you may have somewhere from 500 to 1,000 to 1,500, you could actually pick the best pilot out of that range. But now let's say you have to have five pilots, and there's only five of them that have the 1,500 hours that meet it, so you have to take them because you have to take them, and they could be really bad pilots. But you need them to fly your airplane, and they're only ones available. Whereas somebody who might have 1,000 hours really has the aptitude, the skill. You know, maybe they've been out flying, doing air work and flying gliders. You know, they really have aerodynamics behind them, and they're really, smart kid. But you can't take them. You have to put the other one who maybe just, flew 1 hour 1,500 times. So you don't. It really limits the ability to get the necessary experience because, 1,500 hours is not necessarily 1,500 hours of experience. And here's an interesting stat for you now with automation. They say that now an airline pilot flies less than 2 minutes a flight segment.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
They rotate down and fly international. Yeah. And
Two minutes.
2 minutes.
Explain that, please.
Yeah, rotate, turn the autopilot on out of 500 feet, climb out, you head overseas, automation stays on the way on, kick it off the last, 60 seconds and touch her down.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
and now you have
so with that in mind, Carlene, are you conscientious about hand flying more often? Do you find that what you're learning in the school is playing out on your flight deck?
Absolutely, and it's interesting because it's created such an awareness of this. And I'm on reserve, and so there'd be many, many months I don't even fly. And so I try and, really when I am flying is to really make a point to disengage the automation. But there's times that when you're flying international, you're just fatigued. Maybe you didn't get a good sleep on the bunk. You've been up all night, or you have a brand new captain or something. But quite often, there'll be pilots who are going to disengage their automation and, captain or I'm going to say the captain panics because the captain's doing it. The first officer doesn't say anything because remember, we don't say anything to the captains. But, it's kind of a, what are you doing? Turn that back on, So a lot of them don't even want you to disengage it. Here's an interesting thing that I've learned, though. When I'm flying with a pilot who says, I'm going to disengage automation, and a lot of pilots disengage the autopilot, but they keep the auto thrust on. So for the guys that say, I'm going to take everything off, and they take off the auto thrust and the autopilot, I look at them and I say, do you fly general aviation? Yep. They either fly gliders, they have a little airplane, they're avid aviators. So when I do my research, I'm going to work that into it because I definitely can see a connection between general aviation flying and they're bringing that little airplane stuff. It's giving them the confidence and the skills, and they're willing to disengage automation in their heavy jet. And it's very clear, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, I wish the three of you could get together and write a book together.
Yeah. I'll let those two experts write the book, and then I'll help them edit it.
No. Yeah. Wow. What a conversation we've had tonight. It's a round table, a kitchen table, I call it. But it's been great. And I would like to hear more programs like what we've done tonight in the future with our show, but I'd like to hear it more often on shows that are out there, you know, that want to talk about air aviation and safety. And so it's been really a great conversation with the three of you tonight, and thank you so much. We have extended our time tonight. We're normally a one-hour broadcast radio, but I think this.
You know,
is
I was going to say something about that, but you know,
would
I didn't have
please?
My CRM
no,
training.
Go
I was
going to
speak up and say, "Aren't we running late?"
Yeah, you go right ahead and run us even later if you'd like, Christine.
No, I really was getting nervous about the clock, so I'm glad you explained it. I thought I was losing my mind.
No, I've gone into time and a half on my pay for this show. But at any rate, it's I just don't want to stop because there's so much to talk about. There's so much to talk about. And you guys, you're doing such a brilliant job of this. And I flew back in the days before cockpit resource management, CRM or whatever it's called today. I don't know, SMS and so forth. But I flew way before that time when we were macho guys in the cockpit. When I say macho guys, you take care of your side of the cockpit and I take care of my side of the cockpit. And that's the way it was, right, George? You remember those days probably.
Yeah, I remember that, sure. Yeah.
I bet you guys even carried your own flight bag and your suitcase too, didn't you?
Yeah,
sure
no
did.
Of fact, on my right
it.
Side, I look like when I'm walking, I got something in my right hand that weighs a ton, and that's the flight bag. But we flew back in the day that we didn't have this discussion. We didn't have this, but of course, you know, the automation of airplanes today, it's just a real serious discussion. That should
hey,
be out there. Yeah, please, Don.
How would Slim Cox handle this today?
Well, Slim would always say, "Wear it like a bow tie, son. Wear it like a bow tie," and that's the way he landed an airplane. He said, "You know, you do a full stall. I don't care whether you're in a 747 or a J3 Cub. Wear it like a bow tie." And of course, he got the back end of an L-1011. With Eastern Airlines and cost the airlines a fortune. And when I say the back end, he scraped the tail skid. And he was always doing something that managed to run up our bill with Eastern. And their pilots still probably in the in today's aviation that do it their way. What do you think, Carlene?
Which part of that? Let's see.
Well, do it their way. Are there still pilots that actually fly the way they want to fly instead of the, you know, the safety features that we've been talking about today?
Yeah, you know, we pretty much everybody that I've observed are still they're more or less following standard operating procedures. That's pretty much a given. Every once in a while you see a little modification, but you know, I would say for the most part, we've shifted from everyone doing their own thing to standard operating procedures, which is really important. You know, it is. And actually I probably shouldn't. Yeah. The other last airline I worked for, you go from one airline to another. I went from one airline where everyone was completely standard operating procedures to the next airline where nobody did any standard operating procedures. And then they started, you know, as the years are going on, they're starting to pick up and actually do it. So I think they're learning that there is a benefit to that. And it's not only, you know, standard operating procedure. We fly with so many different crews. You know, if I'm flying with you next day, I may never fly with you again for 2 years. And so we all want to know that we're doing our part in that play. And if somebody's not doing their part in that play, that's a first flag that we know they should be doing what they're doing. So it's getting a lot better, I should say.
Good.
And under and in an SMS, in an airline with a good SMS, the pilots would feel comfortable and they'd feel comfortable in going to the chief pilot and saying, I feel like this non-standard terminology and not following SOPs is, detriment, and that here are the ways and blah blah blah, and they'd sort of get a hearing on that.
They would feel comfortable going to the chief pilot. They would feel comfortable walking into the director of operations and say something. It's really a virtual open door, venue, and they would. Sadly, we're not there yet. Pretty much a lot of the airlines they say it, but they don't live it.
And then they'll call in the pilot you've complained about and chew his ass. Excuse me, chew them up and down, and that's not good SMS. That's bad SMS.
No, definitely not. No, it definitely isn't. And there's got to be a lot of flexibility, too, that here's the thing, that we need to empower our management pilots to make decisions, that you can't just give them rules and say, here's the rule, because there's so many dynamics, and somebody has an issue and they come in. You need to empower them to be able to, on the spot, make a decision.
That's
a very key feature.
Yeah. Well, wow. We are way over time, and I'm just going to say that I would recommend any of our listeners, and we're going to put this episode 307 as one of the best episodes we've ever had. And I thank you so much for your conversation and your insight to especially a subject that we want to talk about often a lot, safety, airline safety, and general aviation safety, I'm sure, has its own problems. But when you have more than four people in an airplane, it lives matter, period. But the number of airplanes that people that we're putting in airplanes today, it's just staggering. It really is. I mean, what's the end of this thing? An A380 with, 500 people or maybe even more? What are we shooting for, a million people in an airplane to transport from A to B? They might be on the drawing board right now. Who knows? Boeing and Airbus are fierce competitors. They are fierce competitors. We see that on the internet every day about how many sales that Boeing has made, how many sales that Airbus has made, and I'm sure they're coming up with different concepts constantly to keep ahead of the other. But
what they really should do. It's a shame. They need to take Boeing and Airbus and say, okay, we're selling to all these airlines. Let's make our instruments and set everything up. Let's use the same terminology. You talked about the acronyms. No reason they could not use the same terminology, because every airline has both aircraft and we're jumping between them. And boy, it would improve safety tremendously if they just called the knob the same thing. So
there
simple.
You go. There you go. Very good. Excellent.
Yeah. All right.
Just remember, people, when you check in, pilot's coming.
Wait a minute. Just a minute. Hang on a second. I know everybody's ready to leave, but I'm not ready to leave. But we're going to leave anyhow. And
may I say that on the website for our listeners to go to www.eaLradioshow.com. Go to web store, go to book review. We have all three authors that are there tonight. They're on the website and they have their information on how to get their books. And people will be able to get it right from the website itself.
Very good. And I'm enjoying your book, Carlene, right now. And I'll probably go home as late as it is tonight, even though you're in Seattle, Washington, but it's late here, and I'll probably read a couple of chapters because it's so entertaining. Thank you so much for putting out a book like that.
Thank you.
Christine, for all the work that you do, and I wish I could see you more often on your TV channel, and you might be hearing some noise in the background, but maybe as producer, I'm the only one hearing that they're telling me I only have 60 seconds before they shut me up. And,
I'm going to say goodbye then, so you don't get cut off. But thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
Thank
you
so much,
both of you.
Great show, Neil. Great show.
Yeah, we're going to land the airplane right now. So, Chuck, how about bringing us home?
Well, folks, that's all the time we have for tonight. Hey, Captain Steve, how about putting Flight 307 back on the ground, kind of gently?
Miami Tower, this is Eastern 307 Heavy. We're about 15 miles out, and we're running low on fuel, and we're lined up for runway 8 right. If it's okay, we'd like to use runway 8 right, and we have it in sight.
Eastern Flight 307 Heavy, this is Miami Tower. I don't know how I got here before you did, but anyway, I'm here. And you cleared to land on runway 8 right. The winds are light and variable, and the present temperature is 72 degrees. Beautiful big bird you got there, Eastern.
Well, if I can find the
Roger, thanks, Miami Tower, Eastern. 30 Heavy is cleared to land on runway 8 right.
Gentlemen, welcome to Miami International Airport. Local time is 8:31 p.m. and the temperature is 72 degrees. For your safety and comfort, please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the captain turns off the fasten seatbelt sign. This will indicate that we have parked at the gate and that it is safe for you to move about. Please check around your seat for any personal belongings you may have brought on board with you, and please use caution when opening the overhead bins, as heavy articles may have shifted around during the flight. If you require deplaning assistance, please remain in your seat until all other passengers have deplaned. One of our crew members will then be pleased to assist you. On behalf of Eastern Airlines and the entire crew, I'd like to thank you for joining us on our beautiful new Boeing 747 aircraft, and we are looking forward to seeing you on board again in the near future. Have a nice day and stay in the Miami area or wherever your final destination takes you. For those going on to San Juan, Flight Eastern 307 is scheduled to depart at 9:30 a.m.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern Airlines. Thank you so much for listening to us tonight. We hope to have you with us again next week when we once again broadcast at 7 p.m. And it's a great program. Thank you so much, Christine, Carlene, and George, for your knowledge of aircraft safety. And we hope to be presenting more of these programs like we had tonight in the future. So, good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern. We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you, Eastern.
Good night. Sleep tight.